Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the 2019 Peggy V. Helmrick Distinguished Author Awardee, biographer and historian Stacy Schiff. Throughout her career, she has brought a wide range of subjects and subject matter to life with vivid descriptions and compelling narrative. From her first book, Saint-Exupéry, a biography, to her most recent, The Witches, Salem, 1692, she has chosen subjects that portray unusual people and events. Saint-Exupéry tells the story of a man most well-known today as the author of a beloved children's book, The Little Prince. But at one time, he was better known for his compelling stories as an aviator during the golden age of aeronautics. Vera, Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov, Portrait of a Marriage, tells the story of a woman who devoted her life to her husband's art and who, in turn, the husband, dedicated his work to her. A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France and the Birth of America, is an account of Franklin's remarkable work in convincing a monarchy, France, to intervene in an upstart revolution against another monarchy, and eventually negotiating the peace that ended the American Revolution. Cleopatra Alive tells the story of a monarch known best as a legend in literature, but it turns out to be an engaging history created from the scant resources known of her actual life. Salem, similarly, tells the actual story of the hysteria that claimed 19 men and women in 1692. Schiff has won the Pulitzer Prize, the George Washington Book Prize, and countless other awards. She'll receive the Helmrick Award this weekend with a free public presentation Saturday morning, December 7th at 10:30 at Central Library. And she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Stacy Schiff, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on the Helmrick Award, richly deserved.
Thank you, Rich. I'm truly delighted.
You know, since your first book came out back in, I think it was 1994, Saint-Exupéry, about the French aeronautical pilot who wrote about his experiences and then ended up writing a children's classic, your books have just grown more bold and more interesting over the years. But when you look at a biographer, a historian's list of works, you tend to see a thematic track or a lineage of subject matter. I'm not sure I see this with all your, everything from Saint-Exupéry to the Salem witch hysteria to the last of the Ptolemaic line and Cleopatra or Ben Franklin in France converting the French to support the Americans during the Revolution. It seems like your books have gone really far afield in each subject from time to time. What interests you in your subjects?
Yeah, I wish I could come up with a unified theory here of how they all fit together perfectly. I think to some extent I end up getting obsessed by a subject or falling under the spell of a subject and then hoping that my own fascination will is something I can convey to a reader or is already shared by a reader in the case of witch hunts, for example. But I also think there may be a reaction, there may be an element of reaction here where one book leads to another in terms of something you don't want to do again, or you said everything you had to say on that subject, and now you want to explore a different mountain. And I'm thinking there of the transition from, for example, Ben Franklin to Cleopatra. Not the most obvious transition, obviously. And the Franklin book had going for it possibly the best documentation of any book I've ever worked on. It was about Franklin's 8 years in France financing the American Revolution, and there are for those years 2.5 times as much documentation as there is for the rest of Franklin's life combined, which was a treat and a curse because, of course, I felt I had to read every bit of it. Much of it is in French. Much of it is not deciphered yet. It's obviously all in 18th century handwriting. It was not necessarily a joy and a privilege. So after that, the concept of writing about someone for whom there was no archival material whatsoever was also somewhat compelling. And the Cleopatra idea actually had been something I had thought about before the Franklin book, but I didn't yet see a way that I could do it. So, you know, there was a little bit of reaction, one book to the other there, and an idea that had recurred that I had had earlier that I had kind of gone back to in a sort of obsessional way.
You know, as I was looking through the subjects and saying, okay, here's a person that reinvented themselves. Okay, here's another book where they reinvented themselves. And then the next book doesn't follow that pattern.
I think a lot of great people who achieve greatness, I mean to say, do reinvent or invent themselves anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, Franklin's obviously a case of that. You know, Saint-Exupéry, whom you mentioned, is born an aristocrat. The path for him is fairly clear. He should follow a military career or a diplomatic career. And he chooses to do something which is decidedly, for the time and place, blue-collar, and has to apologize for that in many ways. And then it's even worse. As an aviator, he becomes a writer, which his aviator friends can't quite stomach. So he's a little bit of a fish out of water, and I think that's somewhat usual with people who go off on an original track. I mean, it's something that many biographical subjects have in common. It's why you often see that celebrated people have changed their names along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in Saint-Exupéry's point of view, I mean, he was a much better writer than he was a flyer.
was the charm for me, because, you know, there's an old adage about, you know, what makes a great drama, keep your hero in trouble. And here was someone who was consistently crashing his aircraft. So I had no problem injecting drama into the book. You had to just wait 20 pages and there would be another crash. And most of those were, in fact, written down to pilot error. And certainly the end of his life, it's repeated pilot error. But part of that was distraction, because in the cockpit, he was very busily writing what we would know to be some of the most sublime passages about flight ever written. And his mechanics would always talk about cleaning his aircraft afterwards, and they'd find these crumpled up balls of paper in the cockpit. So we know part of what was keeping his mind from being on the flight.
Yes. And the other thing is, you know, here he is, he wants to be known for writing these lyrical descriptions of flight, and yet today we remember him for the children's book, you know, The Little Prince.
Right.
And we don't really, I think it's not really well known, the books about flight.
And they're so brilliant. I mean, they really are the classics of aviation. But yes, it's a crowning irony, isn't it, that we all know The Little Prince, and very rarely outside of a French classroom anymore does anyone read Wind, Sand, and Stars or Night Flight, which is arguably the best book that he writes. No, there was a great statement about him made by one of his commanding officers fairly late in his career, who basically said when the flight was dangerous, Saint-Exupéry was brilliant. But when the flight was normal, then he was obviously in danger.
Because he was bored.
Stray. Exactly. Mind tended to stray at those moments.
Well, what I found interesting about a lot of your books is the readers often know something about your subjects, but your books sort of flip that knowledge on its head. For example, Saint-Exupéry, or what we know about Cleopatra, for example. Cleopatra is really known for one thing, and your book explores, no, she was this brilliant Machiavellian figure, well, you know, 1,500 years before Machiavelli, and really playing off one side from the other. She was a brilliant politician, diplomat, and also a fairly ruthless ruler.
Cleopatra was tough, not for the obvious reasons of there being next to no documentation, but because we're all of us up against this conception that Cleopatra was Elizabeth Taylor. And they weren't related, in fact. And that we have this indelible image in our minds of what Cleopatra looked like, which in some way is a fusion of Nefertiti and Elizabeth Taylor. And when you do go back to the ancient sources, you see very clear evidence, both in the coins that she mints herself and in the Roman accounts, that she is renowned for her charm, but by no means famous for her beauty. And we actually have a fairly good sense from those coins of what she did look like. And in fact, she doesn't seem to have been a great beauty. There are a lot of great beauties in Roman literature, but people are very quick to mention it. No one will mention it in terms of Cleopatra, whom Plutarch says was, in fact, much better known for her charm. He said you couldn't resist the contact of her presence. And that was a book where I really had to think a lot about who the sources were, which, of course, is something we should always think about. And the fact that this is a Greek woman whose story comes down to us largely through Roman men, who were many of them writing for Roman emperors who felt hostile toward her, in one case who had defeated her, and in one very blatant case had waged a civil war against his brother-in-law, Mark Antony, mm-hmm. and wanted to cover that up. So who had every reason to make his great antagonist, make Cleopatra into his great antagonist, and to exaggerate her importance and her wickedness.
Yeah.
And so we have a very very tendentious record when it comes to Cleopatra.
So we write of her as the female temptress, as opposed to a diplomat, to a very powerful, wealthy, and intelligent woman.
Well, I think the thing that really riles the Romans, and it took me a little while to realize this as I was reading the accounts over and over again, was that she is the richest person in the Mediterranean world, period, by far. And that really annoyed them. I mean, there is this very potent mixture of envy and contempt on their part, even in her day, toward Cleopatra, because she's outlandishly rich. As a modern historian has said, it was like all the hedge fund managers of yesteryear rolled into one. I mean, she's completely off the charts from their perspective. And that was unforgivable.
You mentioned she's one of the richest persons on the earth. She is constantly juggling shifting alliances throughout her entire life. She's co-ruling with a brother. The brother wants her pushed out and killed, and she is perhaps more ruthless and does the job better. She was audacious and utterly ruthless towards her enemies, and yet she could be utterly charming. And the beauty you talk about is that mixture of power, charm, and intelligence, I think.
Yeah, I mean, here was a woman who spoke 9 languages, something we tend to forget. And the other thing we tend not to think about, when you think about what did this woman do all day, I mean, she wasn't really lounging around with Julius Caesar most of the day. She was running a country. She was making decisions about Egyptian currency. She was monitoring her fleet. She was meeting with her tax collectors. She was making decisions about foreign policy. It was a hefty number of responsibilities in the course of the day.
I was struck by a couple things that you kept coming back to, the fact that she was flawless in speaking to whether it was a adversary or in coming up with an alliance, trying to create an alliance with the Romans, with first Julius Caesar, then Mark Antony. And the other thing is her willingness, you know, she was what, the 9th Greek ruler of the Egyptian Empire? She's the first Ptolemaic ruler to actually learn Egyptian, to actually speak to her subjects in her own language.
Which is astonishing, right? You think someone might have thought of that sooner. There was a real divide, I mean, a real class divide in 1st century BC Egypt between the Greek sort of aristocracy who ruled the country and the Egyptian people and who speak a demotic Egyptian. And she's the only Ptolemy, the only ruler of her family, to bother to speak both of those languages, to be able to really work with both constituencies. And you can see some sense of the affection her people must have had for her in how calm Egypt is during those years. It's a very, normally a very fractious history. There's a lot of civil unrest. There's relatively little during the reign of Cleopatra, which does speak something to her ability to take care of her people. It's very clear from the ancients that she spoke many languages, but that she spoke flattery particularly well. Hmm. And you see that a lot when Julius Caesar and Mark Antony come calling, her ability to relate to these two very, very different Romans who have the same education, the same background, but who are very different kinds of men, and whom she both clearly seduces immediately. By seduces, I mean as a person, is really extraordinary.
And she also seduces them.
We don't know who seduces whom, and that's why I caught myself there. I mean, you know, that's one of the things about having only Roman sources. I mean, the way the story goes, she appears before Caesar, not quite the way Elizabeth Taylor appears before Richard Burton, but she appears before Caesar. She's a young woman whose kingdom is under siege by her brother and his army. And the way the story comes down to us, this 18-year-old seduces a middle-aged man. It's not impossible that Julius Caesar seduced Cleopatra.
Right.
This makes for a less good story, and you're up against Shakespeare, which is a very tough match.
Right. Now, what's also interesting about her is the fact that in her line, the Ptolemaic line in Egypt, it's just constantly one relative killing the other. And at the end of the book, you say, you know, this is perhaps Cleopatra's biggest export to Rome, is that after, you know, Octavian becomes Augustus, she puts herself out of the picture. He is able to take her riches, which actually makes Rome incredibly wealthy. All of a sudden, that necrocide that is a part of the Ptolemaic politics comes to Roman politics.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it, that the Romans who go on decrying the wealth and the wretched excess of Egypt, as soon as they have conquered Egypt, just vacuum up all of that wealth and all of those master craftsmen and all of those opulent traditions and bring them immediately to Rome, where, of course, they all flourish. And that's what gives us the monumental Rome, you know, of which we know today, because Rome had been really a muddy provincial backwater in Cleopatra's time. But yes, the sibling murdering, and it's also, you know, parents who send armies against children and spouses, is pretty much axiomatic among the Ptolemies, among Cleopatra's dynasty. And there are some prize passages about this in Plutarch, about how he basically says, you know, it's the kind of thing that happened in the best of families. but the standard operating procedure really was, it was going to be you or your sibling, and you were in danger until you had pretty much resolved that problem. So that in Cleopatra's case, for example, there's an older sister who, when their father decamps at one point early on to Rome, usurps his throne. So on his return, he eliminates her. That leaves Cleopatra with 3 siblings. With one, she's engaged in a civil war when Caesar arrives. And because she manages to ally herself with Caesar, they fight the brother who dies in that civil war. So 2 siblings left to go. the other sister immediately escapes to what is modern-day Turkey, and she hides in a temple there for many years, plotting her return. The other brother, we're told, Cleopatra will poison after the Alexandrian War. And then the sister remains on the scene for several years until Cleopatra takes up with Mark Antony. And at one point, they're making a deal as to who's going to finance what and what she can do for him. And as part of that deal, Mark Antony offers to her, Mark Antony is obliged to go to Ephesus, where the sister is based, and eliminate the sister. And that's the end of any way the Ptolemaic threats to Cleopatra's reign.
My guest today is Stacy Schiff. She's a biographer and historian, the author of Cleopatra, A Life. The most recent book is The Witches, Salem, 1692. Three other very highly acclaimed biographies and histories. And she's the recipient of the 2019 Peggy V. Helmrick Distinguished Author Award, given by the Tulsa City County Library and Library Trust. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Let's talk about the witches. This is, I think, perhaps your biggest book of just a huge story. And, of course, I have to admit, most of what I learned from the Salem witch trials, I learned from Arthur Miller's The Crucible, which was really about McCarthyism. But actually, the history turns out to be pretty good in the play. But the scale is all wrong. This is a really interesting, crazy time in early American history. And it's really hard to get your head around what happened.
It's a much larger story geographically. And in the sense that it starts in Salem, and it ultimately will entangle 25 different towns. So it's really that entire part of eastern Massachusetts that's involved. And you have whole towns that are cowering behind their doors, worrying that the next knock will be at their homes. But it's a larger story, too, in that, yes, the entire religious and all of the authorities, the religious and civil authorities, are all of them implicated in what's going on. And it is a political story as much as it is a village story. It really is the entire colony in one way or another that is involved.
And of course, you try to put us into what it's like to be a late 17th century citizen of this theocratic colony and really try to put it in their eyes where a person flying across the body of water is not totally unbelievable.
Well, you know, the essential thing, and I couldn't figure out a way to remind the reader of this enough, is that if you lived in 17th century New England, you believed in witchcraft, period, full stop. You have a Puritan colony in which everyone is very familiar with the Bible and everyone is familiar with biblical references to witchcraft, and where that is the fundamental text. So there were relatively few people who doubted the existence of witchcraft. And it's actually important to point out that even after the trials will end in the late fall of 1692, the belief in witchcraft persists for some time. It's just that the trials are shut down. People will still be accused of witchcraft even after the witchcraft court is shut down. But the level of piety and the belief in witchcraft tended to go hand in hand, so that the crisis is certainly exacerbated and accelerated by the Salem village minister, who is new to his pulpit. He was at odds with his congregation, who has a sick daughter and niece, and who has at a certain point every reason to insist on one's godly duty being to point out the potential witches in the community, to point out the potential malefactors, those people who might be working in league with the devil. And you would have considered that your obligation and your religious responsibility to help, to out these people. So there isn't completely, I wanted my neighbor's horse. There's also a certain sense here of doing God's work.
And they were aided by a civil theocratic authority that was all too willing to accept all of these stories and even bend the rules when even the evidence didn't seem to match it. And there was not a lot of evidence. It was a lot of supposition and hypothesis presented as fact.
You know, the lovely thing about witchcraft is that it can be made to account for anything. It's unbelievably elastic. So it can arrange for why you can't find the kitchen scissors, as well as why your horse might have died, as well as why there's no milk on the table tonight. Or my favorite is the teacup that appears outside, and no one can figure out how did the teacup transport itself from the kitchen table to the yard. And it also, of course, helps to vacuum up all of those long-lasting, generations-old antipathies. So the person you felt envious of, or the person who made you feel insecure, or the love affair that had gone wrong, or the love affair that was unrequited, this gives you an opportunity to settle those scores. And one of the things that was most helpful in writing about the witchcraft, where we don't know everybody's motives, because a lot of this is gossip, as you say, and there's no paper evidence for it, is to go back and read the court transcripts of the previous 30 and 40 years of the previous generation or two, and you see the same names recurring. Oh, it's a very litigious society. Everybody's in court. And everyone's in court over utterly mundane matters. But you see a lot of the same finger-pointing and a lot of the same grudge-bearing that you'll see resurface later with the witchcraft accusations. A lot of the same names come up. And you'll realize that people are litigating with witchcraft, many enduring and in some cases generations-old problems that they have with friends and family and neighbors.
But there's something about this particular time where this hysteria takes hold, and that is a driving force. I remember Harry Truman once saying that periodic hysteria is a sort of an innate American trait. I don't know if he originated that, but he was fond of saying that. And he would refer to Salem, McCarthyism, which he presided over, the anarchist hysteria in the early part of the 20th century, know-nothingism, and many would say the anti-immigration feeling today.
Yeah, this, which is very similar. I don't need to tell you this. Yeah. It's very similar to what happened then. And that's where you get into some of the... And this is an event that has many causes. There is not one thing that sets off the trials and sets off the prosecutions anyway. But you have Coney that's emerging from a very savage war with the Native Americans, with what they would have called the Indians. And it's still, I mean, many of these families are families who have been traumatized by the recent war, who have lost family members, who have seen atrocities, who have injured relatives still living with them. It was at the end of an exceptionally cold winter, which had been, for many reasons, for the minister in question's house, very frightening. There was the firewood supply was not secure. You have a new government, there's a new administration coming in, and no one at that point knows who is going to take over and how responsible the colony is going to be to London, if, whether they're going to have the kind of autonomy they're looking for. Is the church going to be allowed to do what it's always done? You have a certain amount of economic distress. This is a slightly depressed time, economically speaking. So you have a lot of strains on the community. And that sense of the feeling of foreign invasion weighs very strongly upon the community, both in terms of, interestingly enough, British soldiers and in terms of Native Americans. They really feel very much, the communities feel very much as if they're under siege.
So do you think that idea that the anxiety about the present and the near future, that sort of unease about where you are at this you know, age of anxiety sort of situation, that has something to do with that hysteria as well as other hysterias that have occurred in the United States through the years?
I think that the thirst for or the use of a scapegoat, and it's incredibly useful, it's incredibly cathartic, and it bound the communities together. I mean, there was certainly an element here. People feel as if they are being driven apart and people feel terrified, but there was also a certain binding aspect to this ferreting out of people who were thought to be in the league with the devil. And it's a reason, in some senses as well, for the prosecution. You have a new government which is trying to prove itself, and which will prove itself all the more valiantly if it can prosecute quickly and efficiently and with little gray area. And so it is in the authorities' best interest to prove to their overlords, so to speak, in London, that they know how to, they're a law and order government, that they know how to handle this situation gone slightly off the rails. So it's very useful to the authorities as well to have had this particular crisis and to be handling it with what we today seem to be, know today to be a misplaced sense of justice, but what they thought of as a particularly clean-cut set of standards.
Well, I have to ask you this. We're hearing a lot of talk about witch hunts today, usually being tweeted. What's your thought about the idea that we're still using this term? And of course, I think you have written and said, you know, this is completely opposite to how a witch hunt actually works, how we're describing witch hunts today.
Well, traditionally, a witch hunt is something that the powerful work on the powerless. And if you look at it today, I mean, it's very difficult to be the most powerful man in the free world and complain that you are the victim of a witch hunt, because you are the one who is in the position where you can dole these things out. No one, of course, had complained about a witch hunt in the 17th century. That's a modern term in the first place. The idea that invisible evidence, trumped-up evidence, can be used against you is certainly what a witch hunt is all about. In the case of Salem, this was evidence that only the accusing girls could see. No one else in the courtroom could see it. But because the girls were in such agony, and clearly something was affecting them, and no one had a diagnosis, it was assumed that they, first of all, were telling the truth, and second of all, were really suffering from what could only be explained by witchcraft. That's a little different, certainly, from the way we see it today. But that sense of targeting someone unfairly is probably the only thing that the two really have in common.
Well, it is a fascinating book, as all your books have been. They're just really, and you give readers such an interesting entree into the worlds that you decide to describe, but just the way your prose goes about it and the journey you take with the readers is really a joy to read. And that's been the case since Saint-Exupéry back in 1994. I know you've published a book about every 5 or 6 years. It's been almost 5 years since The Witches. Are you about ready to release another book, or where are you? What's engaging your interest these days?
I think my publisher is paying you to ask this question. I'm working on a book about Samuel Adams. And so it's really a book about the 15 years before, just before the American Revolution, how the Revolution really coalesces. And it began because in reading the other founding fathers, all of them salute Adams as the man of the hour, basically say this could never have happened without Samuel Adams. And this is a little bit like Cleopatra. Well, what do we know about Samuel Adams other than the fact that he's a beer? We know almost nothing. So that made me sort of scuttle back into the archives. I knew a little bit about him from, I'd worked with the materials a little bit when I worked on Ben Franklin, whom I really wanted to go back to. And I think there was another genesis for this project, is that I was missing Ben Franklin. And here are two very similar in many ways sons of Massachusetts who, in Adams's case, was particularly well-educated and who just sort of swallows John Locke, hook, line, and sinker, is completely obsessed with the ideas of liberty and the pursuit thereof, and who really is the driving force in those years before the Stamp Act and through the Stamp Act up until 1776. So it's really an examination of how Massachusetts takes the lead, how the Revolution gets off the ground, and who was behind it.
And he's almost like an igniter of the Revolution, but once the Revolution is fully engaged, he disappears to history. It's almost like he was too dangerous a force to be a governor, but he's sort of the igniter of a situation, and he sort of disappears to history.
I think that the real talent was a talent for fomenting as opposed to for governing. He does become governor of Massachusetts after John Hancock dies later. It's not his shining moment, however. But yes, and I also think that you don't, after a revolution, want the revolutionaries around. You want to go back to things being calm and settled, and you don't necessarily want the people who are upsetting the apple carts to be the ones running the show.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Is there any publication date at this point, or are you still deep in research?
I really do believe my publisher has got to you, haven't they? No, I don't have a publication date for you yet, no. But I will.
In the meantime, we hope a lot of people come out to see and hear you as the Helmerich Distinguished Author winner for this year. Stacy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich. It was great to talk to you again.
Pulitzer Prize winning biographer and historian Stacy Schiff speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her most recent book is titled The Witches Salem, 1692. She's the recipient of this year's Peggy V. Helmerich Distinguished Author Award from the Tulsa Library Trust and the Tulsa City County Library. She'll be talking about her work Saturday morning, December 7th at 10:30 at Central Library at 5th and Denver. That is a free public presentation. Information at tulsalibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.